So, I'm sitting here actually feeling pretty happy and feeling like a happy person. So, that's nice. And one of the reasons why I have a degree of happiness is because of the topic I'm going to teach today, which is about the Four Noble Truths. And I'm very fond of these four truths. I think they're brilliant. And they are, some people say it encapsulizes all of Buddhism. It can be encapsulated within the Four Noble Truths. And maybe that's the case, depending on how you interpret the Four Noble Truths. And I'm going to do a presentation for you on these wonderful things. That's going to be 4 by 3. And so the Four Noble Truths are the four, and the three are three perspectives or three levels, maybe, or three approaches to understanding these Four Noble Truths. We find even in the ancient world, time of the Buddha, seemingly, that there were different teachings on the Four Noble Truths. And certainly ever since the Buddha, Buddhists have come up with all kinds of different ideas about the Four Noble Truths. And all you have to do is, well, I think it's changed now, but there was a time when in Wikipedia, if you looked up the Four Noble Truths, they had six quotes about, you know, what modern teachers are, how they define the Four Noble Truths. And it was wild, you know, the wide range of Wikipedia definitions, you know, what they have. And that was interesting. And one of the unattributed quotes came from me. maybe just as wild as the others. And but there's a long tradition of in Buddhism to understand them in different ways, and that's part of the richness of them. They're a wonderful rubric for understanding our lives. And I'm going to do three different perspectives, and I hope my idea is that if any little bit of luck, that I'll take you on a journey through three different levels of the practice around these truths, and to give you some sense of these, you know, what it's like, the levels I'm going to talk about. If you have a really cheap, low resolution camera and you take a picture of a mountain in the distance, if you blow it up, it just becomes blurry. You don't see anything. If you have a medium resolution camera and you take a picture and then you blow up the photo, you might see a little more detail. You might see that there are trees on the mountain or some different details. But if you have one of the highest possible, you know, resolution cameras, you know, something like they had that they do for the satellite maps and or something, or, you know, just really high resolution, and you take a picture of the mountain, you can see incredible detail. And you can see, you know, almost like pebbles maybe on the mountainside or something, and you really see close up. So our ability as human beings to perceive comes with different resolutions, or comes with different degrees of clarity. And another metaphor I could have used was light. So just as the first little inkling of dawn happens, and you try to see what's going on, you might be lucky just to, you know, the mountain, maybe take a picture of it or something. You're very lucky to maybe all you can get is the outline of the mountain. A little bit more dawn happens, and you start seeing not really a lot of colors yet, but you start seeing the shape and some of the details of the mountains. But when the sun has finally risen in a clear sky, then you can really see the mountain in a clear way. And so in the same way, our attention can get clearer and clearer. And it can be clouded over, it could be still dark. And then over time, as we practice, it gets clearer and clearer, and we see so much more detail. And one of the ways that the Buddha talked about seeing detail was in his metaphor, simile for the experience of awakening. One of them was that it was a lake, a very clear lake, where you stand on the edge of it, and you look into the lake, and because it's so clear, you can see right to the bottom of it, where you see the shells and little rocks, and you see fish swimming around in the lake. And that was his metaphor for the clarity of mind that happens when someone has the experience, the insights that are liberating. That often, I think, in these Buddhist texts, it doesn't say this explicitly, but water is used as an analogy or metaphor for the mind. And so this clear lake, the mind gets clearer and clearer, like a lake that's just, you know, expansive and wide and deep and pure and clean. And then with that clarity and of the mind, then it can see some of the details of what goes on in the mind. And we see see some of the terrain of the mind, the shells and the little rocks. And we see some of the things that are moving in the mind, the changing and moving around. And in seeing these things, then some kind of liberation, some kind of freedom or letting go can happen. So the three different levels of the Four Noble Truths have to do with different levels of clarity or resolution that allows us to see things in particular ways. All three are very good, and the three ways are relevant in different junctures of our life, different circumstances of our life. The first level is probably one of the most common interpretations of the Four Noble Truths, and that is that there is suffering in this world, and suffering has a cause. And that cause is thirst or craving. And the possibility of ending that thirst, and the way to do that is to follow the Eightfold Path. And the pivotal piece of this is that there's a cause to suffering. And then some people rack their brains, start to understand that, and they have exceptions and protests around the idea of cause. But in many circumstances, to have a sense that there's a cause for suffering kind of leads people right to what's most pragmatic and practical in their life, what they can deal with. And if life is busy and we're not really getting into the details of our mind and what's going on, just seeing what conventionally is called a cause can make a big difference. And here the cause that is said to be something psychological, and it's offered as a metaphor, thirst, which is a little bit more, you know, it's usually translated as craving and into English. And I think of it as when you're really, really thirsty, there's a kind of compulsion or drivenness to find water, a need to find water. And so sometimes the attachments we have, the cravings, the desires we have a quality of compulsivity. There's a drivenness behind them, and we just can't put them down. People might say, I couldn't help myself because it was so strong, the desire, what we had to do. But to see what that desire is and what that thirst is, for some people, is eye-opening. Some people realize, I have a choice. I had no idea I had a choice. I thought I was supposed to just suffer. I thought suffering was just part of life, and I was going to bumble around, and I had to tolerate my suffering. But start seeing, well, there is, you know, an option here. There's an option of letting go of that craving, letting go of that thirst. And sometimes it can seem so simple. And in fact, sometimes it is very simple. If you're standing, if you're in your car at a traffic light and it's red, and you are like, you know, have one foot on the brake and the other foot on the gas pedal roaring to go and, you know, skidding your tires and you're like so impatient, you know, and, you know, you're just kind of, you know, just ready to go. But, you know, not only is there a red light, but there's a car in front of you and, you know, and you're pushing against their bumper and, you know, and everyone's upset around you or scared of you or, you know, and it finally occurs to you, you know, this is really a drag. I wonder what the cause is. I have this craving to get somewhere. You know, I have some impatience. What about if I just kind of ease up on this? And so in that kind of situation, maybe it seems kind of obvious, you know, what to do. Just relax a little bit and wait for the light to turn red to green. So that might seem to work. Some people feel oppressed by this teaching of the Four Noble Truths because there's so much suffering in the world that seemingly the primary cause is not your own psychology, your own thirst and craving. People do a tremendous amount of horrible things to each other in this world. And to kind of keep talking over and over again that the cause of suffering is your craving, like you're responsible, sometimes is a avoidance of really where the attention should be. And so, you know, sometimes the cause of suffering is in our institutions, in our society, and how people treat each other. And we should never kind of overlook that and forget that. But where we have the most ability to make a change, hopefully, is in ourselves. Our success rate in changing institutions in our society, the politics right now, you know, is probably each of us is probably pretty small, but we can change ourselves and we can make ourselves a effective agent for change and someone who can maybe support society in a radically different way. There has to be someone in our society who has discovered how to plumb the depths of their hearts and discover how to uproot the cravings, the clinging, the attachments, the fears, the hates that's in there, and kind of cleanse it, make the lake clean. So show there's an example, this is possible. Because if no one does that, and we don't see that that's possible, then it's just about making more rules, you know, don't act on your hate or something. And so so the Buddhism specializes in this kind of internal looking and looking at what is our contribution to our suffering. And I hope you don't see it as being the only cause for it, but the mature Buddhist thing to do is to kind of look at what is my contribution? And to have this idea that there's a cause, like my craving, my thirst, can be pretty straightforward. And for some people, it's a huge aha that when they learn this kind of teaching, because they thought, you know, for some people, they grew up in a situation where their family, their society, everyone is kind of denying that there is suffering in the world. People kind of put on a rosy picture or kind of claim it's kind of something. Or people don't really want to look at suffering because they put all their hope in an afterlife, being born in heaven or something. And so there's a kind of an avoidance of really looking head on at what's really happening here. And some people find that the Buddhist teachings that emphasize, yes, there's suffering, a relief to hear. That somehow there's a willingness to name it, willingness to be open to it, willingness to stop and take a good look and respond to it and work with it. And that's certainly my ideal for what Buddhists do, that the Buddhist bumper sticker would be, I stop for suffering. And then to stop to look, to understand, wherever we see it, whether we see it in ourselves or see it around us, that we really, you know, are willing, we have the ability to stop and look. But we also, in terms of practice and being here on retreat, to really, it is an opportunity to begin looking deeper at ourselves. And we start uprooting some of, or seeing some of the things that we do here. And so if there happens to, I don't know if there's going to be cookies today. Sometimes there's cookies on retreat at that supper. But maybe someday there might be cookies down there, and maybe you've managed to have 13, and you're quite full, and because you've had 3 bowls of miso beforehand, and you know, and 13 cookies, and then you feel this tremendous desire for another cookie, but you feel your belly, and so it dawns on you, you know, this craving I have for more cookies, it's not serving me. I think it's a time to let go. And so you don't do it. Or maybe it's not even going for the first cookie. You spent the whole day calming your mind, settling your mind. And it's so serene, like a lake, clear lake. And you see the cookie, and you feel the desire well up, and you feel how that the cookie's innocent, but you feel that, you know, this craving is like this energy is bubbling up, and you're in the back of the line, and you start looking from all the way across the community hall to see it. Try to count them and count how many people ahead of you in line, and you're feeling you're getting more and more agitated, and you spend the whole day kind of getting calm. And wait a minute, this desire for a cookie is overrated right now. I know something better. The calm, the peacefulness I feel is so much better, so much more delicious. And in the past, I seemed like always I get seduced by these desires like this. But you know, after all the work of today, I'm not going to blow the calm I have just because I'm going to start counting cookies and counting retreatants ahead of me and look at who takes two cookies and judge them and don't they realize and get, you know, So we'd look and say, okay, I'll let go of that. So these examples are pretty, pretty petty or pretty simplistic perhaps, but mostly I wanted to just say something simple that keeps it here in the retreat. And you can fill in the blank and all kinds of ways in your life that we turn around and we shine the light inward. And we start seeing, where are we attached? Where are we holding on? What are we clinging to? Where do we have choice? One of the ways that I like reframing or restating the Four Noble Truths in this first level is, which I think is a little bit less problematic than some of the usual kind of ways presented. So one of the problems is, you mean all suffering is because of my craving? You know, that's kind of saying too much. But I like to reword it this way. If you crave, you will suffer. Rather than saying, you know, craving is the source or the cause for suffering, but if you crave, you will suffer. There might be other suffering. So I'm not making a blanket statement about all forms of suffering. But if you crave, you will suffering. And that particular suffering will stop when that craving stops. And this the suffering of craving is of two sorts. There's a suffering of the craving itself. There's the tightness, the compulsion, the lack of freedom that's there when the craving is coursing through us and strong. And then there's the craving of all the things that are associated with having that craving, the planning, the wanting, the pushing, the demanding, the way we see the world through the eyes of craving. There's all these secondary levels of craving that come. And then sometimes it's the suffering of getting what we want. And then that is, there's all kinds of problems sometimes with getting what we want. It's fascinating to study how this works. Sometimes getting what we want, we realize it's not so satisfying. So what's the right thing to do then? But want something different. And there are people who spend their life going from one suffering to another. Someone in a retreat recently described this quite graphically for that his spouse, they think about, you know, what's ahead, what to do, where to go for the annual vacation. And once they're on vacation, they think about what should they do, what next, and what should they want next. It's always about what's next. They never seem to be able to relax and just enjoy what they have. It's the planning, the wanting. Things are sometimes not as satisfying as they were promised to be. Sometimes what we get is actually painful. Sometimes the craving is not a healthy craving, the things we want. Craving for status, craving for power, craving for sex, all kinds of things, which people end up acting foolish or worse. So ordinary people who don't have much Buddhist practice, don't have a lot of attention to their minds, can kind of understand from time to time that their compulsivity, their craving, their attachment is really the driving force around some suffering. And so it's kind of this somewhat obvious level. Certainly there are degrees of subtlety and detail that we can be seeing that comes from a lot of introspection, but it's more like on the, I don't know if the coarsest level is what I want to say, but that's one level. The other interpretation, the second interpretation for the Four Noble Truths, is that it all has to do with the second of the Four Noble Truths, and that is that the Second Noble Truth is not the cause of suffering, but is the condition, a necessary condition for the arising of suffering. So it's not a cause. So it isn't that if there's craving or desire, you will suffer. But without craving, you won't suffer. But with craving, it's a condition that there will be suffering, but you won't necessarily suffer. Is that something you understand? So, and what's, I think, brilliant, Buddha put a lot of emphasis on conditionality. And he would describe sometimes a whole sequence of conditions leading up to suffering. And a lot of those cannot be seen as causes. They're just conditions for how things are. So we say, if it's going to rain, that the cloud is not the cause of the rain. The cloud is a necessary condition for the rain, but it's not the cause. So many things have to be in place, but they're not the cause, but they're the condition for them to happen. So if you look at our own minds and look at what goes on inside and start looking, what are the conditions in play? So if we get quiet enough, with clear enough, greater clarity, greater resolution, what's really happening here? What's kind of in a greater detail? What are the different elements of coming into play when I'm standing in the line downstairs looking at the cookies way in the distance and I want the cookie? What's really at play? What's going on here? And it might be that, yes, I'm craving it, the cookie, but if I look more carefully, it turns out I'm actually quite lonely. And the loneliness is just exasperated by being together in a community of people in silence for some days. And it's painful to sit with the loneliness. The loneliness is not the cause for craving and not the cause for my all the wanting and suffering around wanting that those cookies. But the loneliness is a condition that's contributed to the craving. And now you have an opportunity to take care of two different things. You can either address the craving and let go, or you can look more deeply and try to address the loneliness, try to understand that and come to terms with that or have a new relationship to that. Or you might then, if you take a good look at the loneliness, you find that there's a desire to be loved, desire to love, that somehow is being frustrated that leads to a sense of loneliness. The desire to love and to be loved is not the cause of craving the cookie, but it's, you know, it's a in the sequence of things, of conditions that led up to that craving. And now we have more options of what to address and to look at. Now we can look, well, this isn't just a matter of my loneliness, but under the loneliness, there's this desire to be loved and to love. Well, that's interesting. And then it turns out that underneath that, kind of around that, is maybe an embarrassment that somehow I have desire to love and to be loved. I thought as a Buddhist I wasn't supposed to have any desires. But then it says, you know, that's silly. This is actually a very tender part of me, this desire to be loved and to love. It's very tender and sensitive. And, you know, what if I just kind of connect to that tenderness and sensitivity that seems to be where that desire seems to come out of. And then it's a whole different game to play. Rather than kind of dealing with your craving, rather than dealing with the loneliness, rather than dealing with the desire to love and to be loved, you're actually dropping really down deeper and deeper to a feeling of kind of tender softness inside that maybe feels vulnerable, feels maybe even has a sense of poignancy or maybe even a little bit of sense of hurt or something. But oh, that's not a cause for the craving of the cookie. The cookie's long since forgotten. Cookies are petty issues now. I'm into something really deep here. It's a really core aspect of who I am and what goes on. What if I try to deal with this aspect of me, open to it, get to know it, hold it carefully, be kind to it, just allow it to be there. It hasn't ever had a chance to be in the sun of awareness before. I've always pushed it away or ignored it or didn't even know it was there. And so hold that very gently and kindly. Breathe with it. And then you're not, you know, and the cookies issue has been long forgotten. Who cares about cookies anymore now? The cookies was just a superficial issue compared to the depth of what was going on inside of us. So when we sit and practice and begin clarifying what's happening, meaning we start looking, feeling, sensing, touching ourselves in deeper, deeper ways, not chasing anything, but not trying to analyze anything, but simply learning to be present. The more we can be present, the more these things begin opening up. If we really offer kind of unconditioned acceptance to our craving without giving into it, just be there and feel it. Then as we feel and allow it to be there, in the cracks of it, you might see the loneliness. Hold the loneliness without just a relaxed way, open way, be present for it, breathe with it. And it might open up and reveal that underneath there, there's a desire for love and to be loved. And then you say, okay, I'll just keep doing this. I'll just keep holding, be present for it and see it and be clear. And then you see, well, actually underneath there's a tenderness underneath there. And then you do the same with that. So each thing is allowed to be as it is, but as we kind of get more present for it, our ability to see, our sensitivity, our clarity gets stronger and stronger. The greater resolution of what's happening, we start seeing it's a bigger mosaic of phenomena happening. It's not a simply one-to-one correspondent cause and effects, but there's a world of conditions that are in play that are contributing. And it's possible to address the conditions. That way you have a lot more options of what to address and work with than if you're only trying to address the cause. So the second kind of interpretation of the Four Noble Truths is, yes, there is suffering, and there are conditions for its arising. It doesn't arise out of nothing. There are conditions in play, and you can look at those conditions. Part of the advantage of conditions is it's harder with conditions to take them personally, which is a polite way of saying take the blame. But if it's cause, I'm causing my suffering, some people will just say, oh, here I am again, you know, I blew it again, I'm a bad Buddhist or something. But if it's just conditions, it's kind of like almost impersonal, or it's deeper than personal, or it's just kind of a different realm of our life than where it doesn't make sense to take blame or criticism or, you know, take responsibility for it in some kind of painful way. So we start looking at conditionality, the conditions of things. And then the Eightfold Path, which is the Fourth Noble Truth, is the practice of putting in place conditions which support us, conditions that help us to settle and quiet down, the conditions which need to be supported or settle down. That to practice the Eightfold Path isn't a cause for liberation or liberation from craving or attachment, but it's beginning to kind of change the conditions inside of us so that there's the underlying conditions begin to heal or settle or thaw or relax. So, for example, if at the end of this chain, from craving cookies to touching the deep tenderness inside, if that tenderness is fertilized, nurtured with the Eightfold Path, with the goodness of the path, that tenderness begins to take a different shape and form and strength and warmth and delight and goodness and happiness. It begins to change our relationship to all this. And rather than being the one who's responsible to do the change and be someone different, we're starting to create conditions that allows them heart and mind to be transformed. So I saw this in myself. There was a time when I was in the monastery where I've often told this, I apologize if you've heard this before, my big suffering for a while was wanting people to like me. And I was in a job where that was almost guaranteed not to happen. So I really got to feel it. And I could see that this was how much suffering this caused me, brought to me. And so I wanted to address this. I couldn't just let go of it. I could see that I had that desire, this craving. But, you know, good luck in letting go of it, you know. It's one thing to see it. It's one thing to let go. But what was going on was I was meditating a lot. And the meditation at that point in my practice had a lot of goodness in it. There was a lot of sense of integrity, of feeling whole, of feeling kind of supported, feeling safe. And I was experiencing myself in a way that I had never done growing up. I changed schools 12 times in the 12 years of grade school. That's a lot of times to be in a new school and new people, and sometimes I was clearly the outsider. Sometimes it was violent. And so it was a lot of different, you know, so this idea of sitting there in a field of goodness and sitting there, something began to thaw and relax inside of me, and I started to feel just content and happy just to be alive. And that became an antidote to this wanting everyone to like me. Because, I didn't need everyone to like me when I felt so good alone, you know, if I felt so full and complete. And so this desire to be liked began to thaw and relax. I did not have the ability to just see this desire to be liked. I saw it. I knew the suffering. I felt the suffering. But I did not have the ability to just let go of that desire. That wasn't available to me. But as I took care of the condition, as the conditions changed, I changed. And then I was able to relax and let go. So the Eightfold Path are these wonderful practices that are meant to infuse our being with healthy conditions, transformative conditions. They aren't enlightening per se, but they certainly help a lot with shifting and changing the conditions of our life. So the second level of the Four Noble Truths is understanding that there are conditions for the arising of suffering, and there are conditions for the ending of it. Then now we're talking much more about practice. I was suggesting the first type of cause, you know, anybody who's wise in life can see this to some degree. But to really start seeing deeper and deeper, you have to be connected to yourself in a deep way, to be settled on yourself. You have to have awakened a capacity for mindfulness and presence. The mindfulness and presence is kind of like the, Andrea did this wonderful idea of the container. You know, it's kind of like the container that can allow something to be held in a new way. And so something can change. The third level of the Four Noble Truths is has to do not with cause, not with the conditions of suffering, but how suffering is a process of change. There is no suffering that is static, fixed, stuck, frozen, unchanging. It only appears that way because we haven't learned to see with a high resolution. Or the sun hasn't, of awareness hasn't really gotten bright enough. So in the dark, it looks like it's like a big mass of suffering that's unchangeable. But as the ability to be mindful to get stronger, as our concentration and mindfulness kind of build, and we're really able to get quieter and not think so much about things, not have a lot of ideas about things, but really experience the suffering directly, not analyze it, not put meaning on it, not take it personally, not create a self out of it, not try to, you know, anticipate what's going to happen tomorrow around it, or look back at the causes yesterday for it, but become a radical simplicity of being. And this is a, you know, is not a quick thing to come to, easy to come to, but the ability to sit still in the middle of our experience, in the middle of suffering, if that's the case, so still, so quiet, and so not imposing ideas and judgments and interpretations on it, not even putting interpretations of cause, not seeing it, not even seeing it through the lens of there's conditions for this arising, because that's a little bit more complicated activity of the mind. But to get really down to the simplicity, the basic building blocks of our experience, which is the kind of the goal of Vipassana practice, and see the changing nature of our experience. See how things are inconstant, meaning that the way human experience works, when we can no longer stop thinking about it, but instead we see it or feel it, is it's a shimmering, changing, rapidly fluxing, things coming in and out of existence, arising and passing, coming and going, moving from one thought, idea, one experience, one sensation, to another one, back to the first one, to another one, maybe back to the first one again. And the awareness doesn't really stay fixed. There's a constant, you know, things coming in and out of attention and awareness. And to be able to sit quiet and still enough to trust our, to trust that we don't have to do anything. We don't have to make anything happen. We just dial in attention to really be sensitive, really to listen or feel or sense or receive our experience very, very quietly, deeply. And just see the shimmering nature of experience, the kaleidoscope or the flow. Some people like the word flow, the flowing, changing nature of everything. And some people will say, wait a minute, Gil, things are not so flowing and changing. My bones, they're hard, and my knees hurt right now, and that, you know, that's not changing, and, you know, my butt is against my cushion, and that's solid, and that's not changing, and my butt's not changing, it's just there. And but in fact, what's changing is the experience of that. the experience of my butt against my cushion is not the butt. It's the experience. And it, but it turns out I don't have a butt except for the experience of it. I mean, I have a memory of it. I mean, right now I don't seem to see it. So I think it's a matter of trust, or, you know, just trust that it's still there. But I don't, you know, it's just an idea. And I have this hardness and a little bit of texture down there right now, and a little pulling against the cushion. And, you know, it's, you know, actually, now that I'm paying attention to it, it's a little aching, and I've been sitting on this too long. And, but it's all these sensations that's what's there. If I kind of, you know, think, but, you know, it's like, yes, of course, then it maybe is there. But if I stop thinking about it and just feel the sensations, almost as if butt and cushion disappear, that's the world of stillness, with just the nature of the experience itself, without even imposing thoughts, butt, cushion on it. And what is, why would you want to do that? Because to have this idea of a butt is a recipe for all kinds of other ideas and complications. For example, I should probably be tremendously embarrassed as a Dharma teacher sitting up here and say butt so many times. You know, this is a setup for me to feel miserable for the next 24 hours, right? So, you know, all this complicated world can happen. But why bother? Why get involved in that? Why not trust and relax and just be with the radical simplicity of just that sensations coming and going, being there? As we do that, we learn something powerful about how we impose ideas, concepts, values, meaning onto a top of our experience. And then we can question it. We can maybe see, well, maybe it's not true, or maybe not necessary to be so complicated and imposing ideas all the time on things. Maybe in this environment, or an environment like this, is maybe a time that maybe I can experiment with not even imposing ideas of future or past. It's just the experience of the moment. Maybe I don't have to impose ideas of me, myself, and mine. In that, in a sense of hardness and kind of pulling that I'm feeling in that area below me, I don't have to see it personally. I don't have to say it's my hardness, my pulling. I don't have to say it's my butt. It's just sensations. So to not get involved with imposing or overlaying me, myself, and mine on top of the experience. To get simpler and simpler. And the deepest, and the amazing thing is, as we get the simpler, it's kind of like the clouds of the morning, or the darkness of the morning, begins to clear more and more. And there's more and more clarity. All the thoughts and meaning and ideas are a little bit like clouds that obscure really seeing. And so as we just feel the sensations, the raw simplicity of it, no longer imposing ideas on it, then we start seeing that suffering, the second noble truth, simply means that we're aware that suffering arises. It comes. It appears. It's appearing over and over again. And the third noble truth is a truth of the cessation of suffering, that it comes and goes, and comes and goes in many moments, over and over again. And if it comes and goes in many moments, one of the times I saw this early in my practice was I had a lot of knee pain. Partly I was doing Zen and we weren't allowed to move. And I had a lot of knee pain. And so I paid a lot of careful attention to it. And it got a little bit fun sometimes because I, from a distance of my abstract ideas, it was just solid and hard pain. But if I brought very careful attention to feel the pain, it was not hard and it was not solid. It was little sparks of fire and stabbing and pulling and tightening that were kind of like dancing around, appearing and disappearing, in maybe as little as a square centimeter in my knee. But within that centimeter was constantly flux. And then I would ask myself, in the space between one little spark and the next, these little micro moments, where's the suffering? Or if it just moved to another place in the square centimeter, where it just was, is no longer, where's the suffering? And it became a whole different relationship to it. And I could feel and see how my resistance, my clamping down, my depression, my self-pity, my resistance to it, my aversion to it, started to shift and change when it did. I didn't take it as being so solid. I didn't identify so strongly with it. This is my pain. I have to do something. It was just this dance of things coming and going. And so this idea that not just suffering, but all things are coming and going, in the flow and the stream of moment-to-moment experience. This is the high-resolution picture, perspective of the Four Noble Truths. And the Buddha, he emphasized suffering. All things are coming and going. All experiences come and go in constant. The Buddha emphasized suffering in the Four Noble Truths for one very important reason. He didn't want people to suffer. And so the focus was on what does it take not to suffer? And so to see the inconstancy, the changing nature, the impermanent nature of suffering is actually very good news. The Buddha spent a lot of time emphasizing, giving teachings that would try to convince people that your suffering is not solid, not fixed, not permanent, not, you know, the nature of the universe. It is, in fact, changing and moving. And to get quiet enough and still enough and deep enough to really just be there at that primal level of experience, simple level of experience, something begins to let go. If everything is flowing and changing, it actually doesn't make sense to cling to it. And so the movement of craving, the movement of resistance, the moving of bracing ourselves against life, the movements of closing down, the movements of blaming and attacking, kind of in this deep meditative state, doesn't make any sense. There's something else going on here. And so to relax, let go, soften into this kind of flow, into this level here, and to realize, what was a big surprise to me when I went through this, and I realized that we actually never cling to anything real. We only cling to our ideas of them. And it's just an idea. Wow. That was kind of humbling and a little bit frightening for a little bit for me. Wow, we only cling to ideas? It's a phenomenal thing to see. And this emphasis on seeing suffering, the arising of suffering, the cessation of suffering, the Buddha then emphasized, this is the path to awakening. This is the way to freedom. Is there this deep, deep resolution, this deep seeing of this. Come out of that deep meditative state, if you have it, then you might come into a zone where seeing conditions is the right place to be and to see and experience our life. If you come into a higher zone or different zone of life, it's look, seeing cause is the name of the game and what's most useful. And so depending on where we are in our life, the circumstance, situations, we might actually be fluid, moving between these different levels and ideas. And so, for example, you know, Gil talks about this deep state of rising and passing and all this, and you're so far away from that. And you're beating yourself up because you can't accomplish that. You sat down to meditate, and 10 minutes you couldn't attain it. And, you know, you must be a bad meditator. Maybe, now's the time to look at the cause. Maybe you're trying to be a good student and get an A, and so you give up that. And that just makes it so much easier. So wherever it helps you, whatever level, whatever perspective is useful, there are many other perspectives of the Four Noble Truths, many other interpretations that are also quite wonderful. And maybe you'll come up with your own interpretations of these four. They're wonderful four categories, four rubrics to understand, frameworks for understand our life. And the Buddha said that to have this insight into these Four Noble Truths is one of the great forms of wisdom, is wisdom. The theme for this retreat. And because we can be creative with these Four Noble Truths, interpret them in different ways, there's a fourth Noble Truth, fourth one. I call it the Four Magnanimous Truths, as opposed to the Noble Ones. There is happiness. There is the cessation of that happiness. There is the arising of the happiness, and there's a path to the arising of the happiness. It's possible to be happy, and it's possible to undermine it. It's possible to somehow get so caught up in things that we lose our happiness. But don't despair. It's always possible for the arising of happiness. And this is the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path are the conditions for happiness to arise. So you see how easy it was to make a new Four Noble Truths? If the suffering thing is discouraging. So find your way. Find a way that brings you hopefully a profound experience of peace, well-being, happiness, maybe, so you can be a happy person. And then, share it with the world. May you all be happy. Thank you.